Hello, I'm Jonathan Overend. Welcome to this latest edition of Sport and the Fields, the brand new podcast in association with Aldi UK, official supermarket partner of Team GB. This is all about how sport makes us feel, what it does to us inside. And I suppose if we're talking about how sport makes us feel, if you're an Olympian right now, it's making you feel pretty uncertain at the moment because one thing's for sure, you're not at an Olympic Games right now. And there's huge uncertainty about whether there will be a Games next year in 2021. We're calling this the purpose episode because I suppose when you're an athlete, certainly when you're an Olympian, your life, your profession, your career has a purpose. You are aiming towards the next major championships, which obviously in this cycle has been the Olympic Games. An Olympic Games which now isn't happening. An Olympic Games which has been put back 12 months, which may or may not happen. For some athletes, it simply has to happen. Right, my co-host for this episode is someone who's a relative newcomer on the broadcasting scene, but I'm delighted to welcome her onto the pod because I'm a big admirer of her work, which goes on all over the place. I mean, she's got so many strings to her bows, it's ridiculous. But if you go to her social media channels, that's very much the centre of Operation Batson. It is Anne-Marie Batson. How are you? All right?
Hello, Jonathan. Thanks for having me.
No problem at all. Well, it's great to have you involved, particularly, I think, on this episode because you've had a purpose in life, haven't you? And if we go back to, say, London 2012, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes, you were not a journalist, you were not a broadcaster, but you knew that's what you wanted to do. And here you are. So if we talk about purpose from an athletics point of view, you know, what a weird situation for these guys to be in.
For many in their minds, they would have seen this year as the last time to take part in an Olympic Games. Their minds would have been very focused and drilled on into that. And then having to be told, actually, you're going to have to wait another year. And the reasons that it was taken was absolutely right. But I can't imagine for an athlete what that is like for them.
No, very, very tricky. I mean, we've got the dates, haven't we, for 2021?
We have.
But I guess we also have to be realistic and pragmatic and accept that there has to be a possibility that it might not happen. So how, as an athlete, do you deal with that? I mean, what a situation to be in. We'll find out in a few moments. Anne-Marie, just before that, though, let's find out a bit more about yourself. What are your early Olympic memories?
My Olympic memories, I would say, would go as far back as the Seb Coe years, I would say, very much between him and Steve Ovett. The classic rivalry. And then Steve Cram coming along, Sally Gunnell, I remember those days.
92 Barcelona.
92, yeah. I think 92 Barcelona was the one that really cemented it, how fantastic this spectacle was. Yeah. And actually that year, later in that year, my parents took us all out because I'm a trio of children, and took us out to Barcelona in the autumn so we could see the Olympic sites in 92.
Up on the hill, and that very open stadium, which you can pretty much just walk into, can't you, off the street.
That's right, amazing experience.
I went there once, couldn't believe it. You're watching all of these on the TV, are you?
Yeah, I was watching on the TV and listening on the radio as well. I remember getting up crazy hours to watch the Sydney Olympics, and I remember for the first few days Team GB didn't do so well, and then all of a sudden I'd get up in the morning and the headlines would be so-and-so's won gold here, so-and-so's won silver here, and it was like this endless run that we were doing so well. All of a sudden it was a fantastic memory. Absolutely,
same thing happened at 2012, didn't
it? Did
it, if you remember, first couple of days it's like, where are the medals, where are the spectators? We were sort of worried it was going to be a bit of a damp squib, but then it all kicked off. You had an interesting role during 2012, didn't it? And it had nothing to do with microphones as such. Tell us about it.
I worked on the railway back in 2012, and I was seconded down into South London to work with a group of agencies to oversee transport communications for people in terms of the public as well as spectators who were making their way around London either for work or for going to the Olympic Stadium. So it was my job to keep an eye on what was happening, if there was any peaks and troughs of traffic. So say, for instance, at peak time, it'd be my job to make sure the messages went out on social media and online, and as well as passenger announcements to tell people where to go and catch their train, or if there was any bottlenecks in the tube, and then I would send messages about that as well. It was brilliant time. I know.
So you were literally keeping the city moving.
Keeping the city moving. That was the one thing. Transport was so important for London 2012, and to be part of that as well.
Could you control the traffic lights?
Security
you didn't
clearance
have like
would
a
allow
big
me that far.
Red, amber, and green button in front of your desk.
No, not at all. But I just remember it was such a buzz as well. Everyone was so excited, and the transport worked perfectly, I have to say.
Right, let's bring things back to the theme of the episode, which is purpose. Let's speak to a man who, for as long as he can remember, has had a purpose in life, and that's to win an Olympic medal. And he very much is hoping, I was about to say was hoping, but let's keep saying is hoping, that his time will come in Tokyo. It's not the most glamorous discipline, I would say, in the GB track and field team, the 20K race walk, but I think you're going to get to know him and get to like him. He is Tom Bosworth, great athlete, Henry.
He is, fascinating character, a lovely man as well. And I've enjoyed watching him grow as a person, but also as an athlete as well. I'm so looking forward to speaking to him.
Okay, let's bring him in. Sixth in Rio in the 20K race walk, Commonwealth silver medalist, it's Tom Bosworth. Oh, here comes Tom.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
Hello, we got you.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
How are you doing?
Hi, yeah, very well, thank you.
Good.
Just had a haircut.
Oh,
so I'm over the
fantastic
moon.
Yeah. Lockdown victories.
Yeah, I know, isn't it?
So, Tom, talk us through it. Is this a highlight of the season?
Yeah, well, so far, it pretty much is, to be honest. I'm sure most people, as soon as they heard they could book a haircut, if their local barbers or hairdresser was taking appointments, I'm sure they did just what I did and got in. And even when I did that about 3 weeks ago, the slots were disappearing quicker than I could type my name in. I was stressed. I'd lost a day already.
Well done. Well done. Small challenges, but big victories, you know, big victories. So, you know, what has lockdown been like for you as a professional athlete? Must be a really weird time.
It's bizarre. I said to my barber this afternoon, it's the first time I've spent this long at home for 11 years, which now I look back, it puts a lot into perspective, certainly. I've been able to obviously keep fit, and at the beginning we were, what was it, late March, so we weren't too far away from putting the final pieces together for the Olympic Games, for what hopefully would have been my second Games. And I had to take a couple of weeks to kind of reset, I guess. I just stopped everything, spoke with the coach, spoke with the whole team, and we just reset. And after that, we just have kind of muddled through. I've learned sign language. Well, hang on. I'm learning sign language.
Okay.
I've been doing loads in the garden. I'm really thankful for having a garden, having that space, and just spending time with my wonderful 2-year-old Black Labrador, as well as my fiance, of course.
Has it been a mixture of like mixed emotions though, Tommy, in terms of it's nice being home, it's nice being with family and with your fiance, no doubt you're planning your future wedding, but at the same time, the desire to get back out there and train as well?
Yes, and I think really I kind of made a bit of a mistake in early May. We started kind of putting some training together and proper sessions, started to train twice a day again, and without having, obviously, the gyms and everything's been closed. I haven't been able to see my doctor or physio or my coach. So I kind of trained myself into a bit of a hole a little bit, because the right setup wasn't around me and the right support wasn't there. And so I should have really just continued to ease through it. Instead, I tried to do full training without the proper kind of support. And so I ended up hurting an old injury and so on. And it's not been disastrous, but it's just, you know, it's just another thing going on in your head when you should have been days away now from an Olympic Games, but instead it's, you know, managing it.
I cannot believe where we are. And I guess for you as an athlete, knowing now that the Olympics now has a set date, how confident do you feel about your training going forward?
Good question. I think it's so up in the air. We know how to manage it. We've got plans A, B, C and D pretty much now for the next 12 months. But it's that unknown which makes it really difficult. Being an endurance athlete, we spend so much time up mountains in random countries at altitude, you know, in Arizona to the Alps in Europe. And it's not knowing where we're going to be, trying to plan getting into Tokyo competitions, whether they'll be held or not, and what races we want to use and target. So we've got a plan, which we think will work, hopefully, perfectly. It's worked in the past. It's just whether we can implement it.
Yeah, and I guess, Tom, that plan is based upon the games actually happening. And I suppose if we're being brutally honest about it, there has to be a reasonable chance that they may not. So from an athlete's point of view, again, when your whole world, your whole occupation, your livelihood is based around gearing up to the major championships, that just must be an impossible thing to get your head around, how to deal with that possibility.
Yeah, and in my mind, it can't be a possibility.
Right.
But obviously, being realistic, yes, it is. If I'm looking at it from kind of the conversations I've heard from within sport, as well as kind of looking at society where we are now, I think the games will go ahead. They might not go ahead in the same manner that we're used to, but I do believe that they will go ahead. I already have heard of, you know, all these different ideas to going into how the games will be held, competition, scheduling, and all sorts. So I don't think, you know, the IOC and other sports governing bodies are just sitting on their hands here. They're just, I believe they're being proactive.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, if you've got an A to D, they've got an A to Z,
Exactly.
But I'm interested in what you said. It definitely isn't a possibility for you. Is that to say that were the games not to happen, that would basically sort of end you as a professional athlete?
Well, I mean, yes, I think it's a simple answer. Unfortunately, this has hit probably my prime. You know, we had targeted Tokyo since the day Rio finished in 2016, and that was kind of a bit of a breakthrough race for me in my mid-20s, and I was ranked 27th, finished up 6th in Rio, and so that gave me the belief that I can compete at the top. And so this has fallen where I turned 30 this year, which in my event, you know, in endurance, it's you can peak into 30, 31, 32. So obviously for me, it's all out. This is my entire career coming down to this competition. So it's going to go ahead because I've got to give my every ounce of strength to get me over the line now over these next 12 months.
But to me, you seem, you know, in terms of race walking, you've done so much to raise the profile of the sport here. And it'd be such a shame if the Olympics didn't go ahead next year, because for me, I've really enjoyed watching you race, Tom.
Oh, well, thank you very much. You know, I didn't set out to kind of be a flag bearer or anything like that. We've got such a rich history, plenty of Olympic medals in the event, and it's a bit of an unknown, forgotten athletic event. And so, yeah, people, when they've started to watch it and see it and watch me race and know that we've got a Brit up the front of these races, they really get involved, and the risk of disqualification as well just adds kind of that bit more excitement to it. And when people hear I walk a 5K, a park run in 18 minutes, they can't quite believe it.
So, I don't believe it myself.
So I've just really enjoyed, you know, the process, and I've just tried to be the best athlete I can be, and it's just kind of gone hand in hand with having to rebuild the event and get it back into kind of athletics competitions and stuff.
I love that image. We're at the park run, and there goes Speedy Tom walking past us, heel to toe. Just give us a practical example then of, you know, how fast would I need to be running to stay ahead of you if you're walking up behind me?
Oh God, no, you're getting me
sorry,
with
I'm
maths.
Getting, I've come in early with the science there. Sorry, a bit earlier than planned. Apologies for that.
You'll have to be running at about 10, 11 mile an hour to overtake. We walk half a marathon at 10 mile an hour. So we do half a marathon in about an hour 23.
Right, wow.
So
you've got,
you know,
me already,
I guess,
you
see. People,
you've had me.
Yeah, what would you aim to run a marathon in 4 hours? So half a marathon in 2. It kind of puts it into perspective that way.
It's amazing, isn't it? I don't know about you, Anne-Marie, but I would be in this man's wake.
I am not a fan of running, Tom, I've got to say. And watching you doing your race walking, I admire the skill and tenacity it takes to do what you do. And I know, even if I was on roller skates, I probably wouldn't be able to catch you up, for sure.
I'd love to find out a bit more about how it all began, Tom. You know, how does a young kid, presumably into some form of track and field at the time, decide race walking is for them?
Yeah, I mean, you certainly don't grow up thinking I want to walk for my country and that ending up being your job. And so it's pretty bizarre. But yeah, my mum just encouraged me and my sister to keep fit, and we joined Tunbridge Athletics Club down in Kent, and I joined like a generic sort of running group which tried a little bit of everything, and trust me, I was naff at any other sport, to put it bluntly. I was, if you've ever seen a picture of me, I'm not built for rugby. You know, I'm never going to throw a shot put very far. But the endurance stuff, you know, it was just me against the watch, I guess. There was no pressure from teammates or anything like that. I just could do it at my own pace and enjoy it, and enjoy it with friends. And
did you quite like that sort of isolation part of it as well, almost?
Yeah, in a way, because there was, you know, I had a coach and other teammates who all just did it for fun as well. But it was just about, you know, me. There was nobody else relying on me, I guess, and there was no pressure on, and so I just kept going, and I wasn't any good at it. I tried running, and there just happened to be this race walk coach at Tunbridge, and my sister tried it out, and I said, well, if Emily can do it, I can do it, and I can do it much better. And I couldn't to start with. It took me about 5 years, and the first time I beat her, she quit. So what does that say?
Was that
thank goodness I didn't.
Well, indeed, but was that the moment the penny dropped and you thought, actually, I could make a career out of this?
No, I mean, that was about yesterday. I realised I could make a career out of this. But I think it was probably late teens when I learned, I could actually be quite good at this. And it's going to be... If I actually knuckle down and train, you know, maybe start doing something every day, I could actually get quite good. The difficult thing is, as a junior under 20, you compete at 10 kilometres, and then you have to step up to the international distance of 20 kilometres as soon as you turn 20. So it's quite a big step up, which requires a hell of a lot of training for a 19, 20-year-old who really just wants to go out with their mates, socialising, drinking, you know, that sort of thing. Being so dedicated, it takes so much restriction and, well, dedication. But I just always took it step by step. I never, ever dreamt I'd go to the Olympics, never thought I'd break records and all sorts. So I think that's why it stayed so fresh and exciting for me, because everything felt like a huge new achievement.
And was there a moment, Tom, that made you think this could actually be a profession in terms of just a commercial, from a making money point of view? You know, I mean, again, it's not the sort of thing you would think could actually be a paid employment, yeah, but it obviously has been.
No, definitely. And what I learned about track and field is that a handful of people get support through, first of all, you know, the World Class Performance Lottery funding program, and I'm lucky I got on there 5 years ago now, so I've had a lot of support through that. But that took a lot of knocking on the door, because they had nobody before me for about 30 years. So there was no performance program or anything like that of how to get a walker to win international medals. So they didn't know whether I could actually be any good. So there was that.
And that's really interesting.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so much about you as an individual. It was almost like, well, your job, your category, we kind of don't know how to fund that, because we don't know how to turn that into a medal.
Exactly. And that was a challenge that both me and my coach has done brilliantly. And we work within the system now, and it's great for the walkers that we've got coming through now. We've got a handful of British youngsters, you know, making major championships, and British Athletics can support them brilliantly now. So that was kind of one challenge that we faced. And I used university and my studies to kind of prolong that amateur status for as long as I could. But what I learned very quickly is, you know, sport is about entertainment and telling a story. And it's far more nowadays than just the start of the race to the finish of the race. It's about the person competing. And I learned, you know, if I live openly, if I live honestly and be myself, I know my friends tell me I've got a lunatic of a kind of character about me, and hopefully that I can get that across. And I think that's what I've done, thanks to the wonders of social media and things like that.
This is Sport in the Fields, in association with Aldi UK, official supermarket partner of Team GB. In 2017, Tom suffered a major blow. He was disqualified from his home World Athletics Championships. Now, this happens in race walking. Officials are watching the athletes to make sure they are indeed walking and not running, and red cards can appear if an offence has been committed. I want to explore this further with Tom. You've said a couple of things in our conversation already today that make me think, okay, well, that possibly, even though it was devastating at the time, wasn't the worst thing in the world. One, the emotion side of thing, the personality, something like that brings your personality out. It definitely did with you that day. But then you've got the jeopardy factor as well. Isn't that one of the reasons we enjoy watching sport, that sort of desire almost, sorry, this is a bit brutal, to see somebody fail, to see somebody caught out, to make that mistake, that sense of jeopardy pulls viewers in. So how do you view what happened to you whole disqualification issue?
I think that's something that really this sport should embrace. It's really part of how commentators should use it. I think, as you say, people see it as a negative thing, and of course it's a bad thing. You don't want to get disqualified, but it's not like false starting or making a straight red card sort of challenge in football. That's not the kind of reason you're disqualified. It's a real, just a tiny little mistake three times in a race that lasts an hour and 20 minutes, and you can be pulled up for that. That's the difference. The reason the rules are there is to stop people from running, basically, to make sure that they're maintaining the race walking action. But
I bet they're not always right either.
Well,
they must be contested all the time by you guys, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yes, yeah. But I just think it's more accepted. You know, there's eight referees rather than just the one in football, and three of them have to give you a red card. And you know, so it's pretty conclusive that normally you don't really see an athlete with one red. You often see them with three or four or five reds, and you know that they've had a bad day. They're not necessarily cheating on purpose.
Right.
And I think that's what we need to get away from, is they don't think it's... People might think, oh, they're trying to cheat and get an advantage. You can literally have one bad lap of the race, and that's what happened to me in London. I had one bad lap, which was... It's a 2K lap up in front of Buckingham Palace, and I received three of my four that day red cards, I think, in that lap, and I was disqualified.
And what lessons do you think you learned from that, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I learned a lot, because I hadn't seen a disqualification for probably the best part of 4 years before then. So it wasn't something that had crossed my mind that could happen. I thought I'd trained and worked pretty hard on my technique, that it wasn't going to be an issue. But That was very naive of me, and I think anybody going into any sort of, whether it's sport or job or anything like that, you know, you've got to think about the whole picture and be ready for anything, and I wasn't ready for that. And since that day, it brought me right straight back down to earth with a bump. You know, I'd come off the back of that Olympic Games. We'd got the first ever race walk in a Diamond League in London at the Olympic Stadium, literally the month before, and I broke the world mile record that day as well. So we were riding such a high for it to come absolutely crashing down to earth. And yeah, I say, you know, the disqualification, all that, it does add a load of drama to it. And people still talk about that day for that reason. It was absolutely horrible to watch. I've watched it back, and it makes me well up now. But it made me realise also that sport, I love my sport. I love everything that I've achieved and how far I've come. But I did it all for my partner, for my family, and I did it off their encouragement. And I think that's what I needed to remember, that it's not the be all and end all.
Definitely. Let's talk a little bit about the Olympics, Tom. What was your earliest memory, would you say, of the Olympic Games? What would it have been that you were watching that kind of hooked you in?
I can remember Kelly Holmes's double in Athens, which would have been 2004. I guess that was probably the earliest, but as I touched on earlier, for me, sport just was never even something. I enjoyed watching a bit of football and that sort of thing, but I never really was that interested in it, because I could never do it, as a real youngster. And so it wasn't until my teens that I really started to get any sort of interest in track and field, football, and so on.
So to go from someone, you know, with just really only a passing interest to going to an Olympics as you did in 2016 and finishing sixth, you know, not far away. And you were, you know, to put that in context, you were pretty pleased with that, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, I broke the British record that day. Yeah, it was...
Well, there you go.
I was over the moon.
So, I mean, tell us about that experience. What was Rio like?
It was a whirlwind of about 10 weeks, to be honest. It was just the excitement of Team GB look after you so well. You do everything from kitting out, which takes about 8 hours to get all your kit, all your Team GB stuff and freebies that you get, and meet the social media teams, and it's just fantastic. And then we flew up to altitude in Europe and spent the next 3-4 weeks away from the media, away from the pressure, training hard there. And then we flew into Brazil, and again, Team GB's holding camp is second to none. They make sure we have everything we need. And then obviously you head into the village, and unfortunately for Rio and Brazil, the country was in a bit of a mess at the time. They eventually got the Olympics, despite being so strong when they actually won the bid for it. So that took the edge off it a little bit. But for me, it was just everywhere you turned, it was just Olympics. The village was this phenomenal, huge area of tower blocks and games rooms and McDonald's. And it was just an environment I've never been in before. You have 10,000 athletes, let alone then the fans, the staff, the people who make it run. And there's everybody wants a bit of you. Everyone wants an interview or you know, what's it like doing this? It's just 10 weeks. It was 10 weeks of absolute fun. That's all I can describe it was. It was just fun.
I bet it was. And Anne-Marie, I bet he was bumping into celebs around every corner in that village.
That was going to be my next question. I mean, obviously, Tom, people recognise you, but you must have walked around going, I know, that's so-and-so, and you're just like walking around the village just completely starstruck.
Yeah, well, apart from the people based in Leeds, which does seem like half of Team GB is based in Yorkshire, if I'm honest. So, but apart from, you know, those handful of people, no one knew who I was, you know, but... As an athletics team, we're used to travelling, you know, there'll be 80 of us in an athletics team. And so I think we're deemed quite dominating in Team GB a little bit. Whereas then you've got like a handful of archers or you know, a few trampolinists or whatever. So we're a pretty big team. So what I realised quite quickly was a lot of people don't know anybody. So it was quite nice meeting people from sports completely out of the blue. I remember... It was about 5 a.m. I'd done an interview back home and come back to the village, sat outside the McDonald's. I thought, I'm going to have a McDonald's breakfast when it opens at about 6. So I had that. I had obviously competed at this point.
Right.
the nutritionist will be rocking back in his
yeah.
Yeah. Go on.
I was eating my McDonald's in the village, and three lads in Team GB kit came over and said, oh, do you want us to sit with you? And I'm like, yeah, sure, come join. And they got their McDonald's, and it turns out that they were three boxers, one of them from Yorkshire as well. And I got chatting to them, and it was just so weird but so nice that this scrawny race walker was sat having this breakfast at 6 a.m. with three boxers and so on. It doesn't matter how famous, how much money anybody's on, or how amateur, if somebody has a job in part-time, everyone's viewed on exactly the same. And I think that's what gets missed a lot. You have these handful of real names in Team GB, and then you've got so many members of the squad making the Olympic Games, yet they work. They have other jobs, they have families, and you know, they don't earn money out of what they do. They just do it because... for the love of it, and they've reached this high level, and that I found absolutely overwhelming.
How final one on the McDonald's. How tempting is the on-site McDonald's when you're still in competition?
I'm pretty strong-minded, so for me
it
wasn't.
Can you?
But
if we dangle that McMuffin in front of your eyes, you wouldn't be tempted.
No, to be honest, I'm not a big fan of McDonald's at all. So it makes it very easy for me, but I thoroughly believe that there's probably a lot of younger athletes who would have been tempted to say, screw the canteen food, I'm off to McDonald's. But I do believe that was the last Olympics with a McDonald's in the village, so we won't have that problem.
Right.
It's been interesting to follow you over the last few years because so much of your role in life and your purpose in life, almost, it seems, surrounds you off the track and off the road, because it's been an important few years for you, Tom.
Yeah, definitely. I don't mean to be anything more than any other athlete who just does kind of, well, tries to be the best athlete they can be. But yeah, as I say, you know, I've lived openly and honestly, which has meant, you know, talking about mental health being still, I think, one of the only out LGBT athletes on Team GB. And so it's just, it's given me amazing opportunities to speak and say my piece and meet some incredible people as well along the way. So it's not always been easy. It's certainly not been easy for the last couple of years or so. But that's taken a lot to learn about, I guess, about me, about kind of what is important in life, and something that's going on right now as COVID-19. It just highlights again, if all sport and all that was taken away, what would I have? And it is the backbone of everything for me is my fiance and my dog, 100% the dog.
I watched a great discussion that you were involved with. I think it was through British Athletics, wasn't it, on Zoom recently, and you had people from different sections of British Athletics all discussing being gay in track and field, and everyone obviously has different personal circumstances, but it's important we have these conversations. Like you say, you don't want to keep saying you are the only openly gay track and field athlete, do you? I mean, you don't want to still be having that conversation in 10 years' time.
No, absolutely not. You know, I came out publicly 5 years ago. Was it 5 years ago? Yeah, 5 years ago now. And it feels like nothing really has changed with sport. It's so far behind society. And we did this Athletics Pride Network through British Athletics, and we had other people from other sports, you know, reaching out to us immediately saying, oh, we want this. We've needed this for ages. Oh, we've got loads of people who would want to be part of this. And it was a fantastic response. And that panel discussion you mentioned, you know, I was really honoured to be part of it. But what I said is I'd quite like to just lead the conversation rather than make it about me, because I feel like I've said my piece and people have heard my story. And now I'd love to help and encourage others to do the same. And so, yeah, we had a trans grassroots runner. We had a gay club coach and a gay up-and-coming sprint hurdler as well on there. So a real mix from all across athletics, and it was fantastic to hear the stories and hear the similarities, but also how completely different they all had their journey, I guess.
It was, and you're right, you were very much the leader of that conversation. I watched it thinking, you know, would they have done this had you not been so visible and outspoken and indeed been the leader of that conversation? So, you know, it's a really important role that you've played.
Well, I never realised, even growing up gay and starting to be involved in sport, I never realised quite the issue sport faces with racism and as well as, you know, the LGBT community just not being represented whatsoever. And I just can't believe it, really.
I guess over time, it's like if we had this conversation 5-10 years ago, this wouldn't have figured at all. But now we are having, like Jonathan says, we are having those conversations. We are having uncomfortable conversations about these issues. It's good that people are starting to feel confident to talk about their experiences and what change they want to see.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm not one for banging the drum and demanding, you know, huge changes and this sort of thing. But I think what was clear is, like what you said, Jonathan, it's just visibility. And I guess I was the first in athletics, and now that's spreading, I guess, and people are confident enough to be visible, like that conversation we had there. That's three more people who are now a little bit more visible, and that might reach a few more people. And that's what it's about. It's
totally.
And hopefully that will make sport far more inclusive.
I mean, what about athletes in other sports? Have you had any sort of emails over the last few years from people saying that you've helped them at all?
Oh, that's something that you know, it truly fills me with pride. Is the amount of messages, especially they often come from abroad, of young athletes coming through, and not even necessarily always athletes, just often people from countries who where it's still illegal, you know, to be gay or you know, even punishable by death in some countries. And they say, I wish I could have a life like yours, or you inspire me to tell my family. And as well as other athletes across sports in the UK have said, oh, Tom, I've just heard your story. And this might be 3-4 years on from when I first came out. And they've said, oh, I've just heard your story, and it's inspired me to tell my parents, but I'm not ready to come out to anybody else yet, but thank you, and so on. And I just can't believe that that's I've had any impact on that. And it just reminds me, you know, that's why it's good to be visible and good to be out there.
Do you see yourself as somebody who can be a voice for another person who isn't ready to speak about the LGBT community, or as Jonathan mentioned, comes from a country where LGBT issues are pretty much a crime? Do you feel you could see yourself as somebody who could speak for others on their behalf?
Yes, yeah, and I think partly I'm probably doing that already without knowing it, if you get what I mean. I feel like I speak now for everybody who has reached out to me, or everybody who reaches out to me afterwards, because what I realise is the thing around sexuality, it's still so, I don't know whether it's sport is seen as a weakness or demeaning in some way, and people are terrified to voice it. And so, but when I do, or when others who are able and strong enough to speak publicly about it, when they do, the messages just come, as we said, from all over, and they're so thankful that we've done it, that's why I keep doing it, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said earlier, you know, we'll wrap this up in just a second. But like you said earlier, you know, it's normalizing the conversation to the point where, I mean, if I think of the work that both myself and Anne-Marie do in football, for example, you know, the conversation has always been along the lines of, well, when is a Premier League footballer going to come out? And you don't want the conversation to be framed in those in those terms, do you? You just want people to live their lives and for everyone to accept whatever it may be.
What you said earlier, Jonathan, there is hit the nail on the head. What will ultimately happen is that it will take a confident character, but there will be a young footballer now who's able to feel comfortable in their own skin, comfortable with the support of their family, to live openly and happen to also be very good at football and grow up through
yeah,
the academy
completely.
And through the club. And ultimately the media will turn around and go, oh, when did that happen? And hopefully that will then be the beginning of the end of this absolute unnecessary but very necessary topic.
Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure. All the very best for everything that lies
ahead.
Thanks,
Tom.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on. Thank you, guys. Thanks so much.
Magic.
Thank you, Tom.
So there we go, that's Tom Bosworth. Great to have him on the pod. Terrific as well to give some publicity to the discipline of 20K race walking. Let's be honest, it's not the sort of Olympic discipline which makes it to the back pages every day, is it? So good luck to Tom in his quest not only to be in Tokyo, to make it there, but also to medal. He's a terrific athlete and a great personality as well, Anne-Marie.
He is such an amazing person to speak to. I felt like we could have talked to him for hours about an amazing range of topics. But I feel like somebody, he's got a lot of love out there. He's got a lot of warmth as well. And I love the fact that he's been somebody who's been a trailblazer for the LGBT community in terms of track and field. And he sees this as part of, as we say, his purpose now, his role in life. And I think that's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, definitely. And you could hear almost the frustration in his voice towards the end there, that, you know, we're having to ask the same old questions and having the same old conversation. He wants to be part of something different in the future, and he should be able to be part of something different in the future, a better future. And why does everything take so long in these areas, do you think?
Oh, I really don't have an answer to that. I get frustrated myself about why these issues take so long to resolve, if that's the right word to use. But the one thing I'm confident of is that Tom strikes me as a person who won't let the issue fade away. He'll make sure that people keep talking about it and action is taken.
Anne-Marie, thank you very much. We'll hear from you again, I'm sure. Make sure you subscribe to get the whole of the series. If you've missed some of our previous episodes, do catch up. Mark Pugach and Claire Balding were together on episode one. Hear Catherine Merry, absolutely brilliant, on Kathy Freeman Night at Sydney 2000. That was episode two. The best thing you can do is subscribe and get the whole series, Sport and the Fields, coming your way throughout what would have been Tokyo 2020. We'll see you next time.
Fields is a 94.19 independent production.
In association with Aldi UK, official supermarket partner of Team GB.